Why would two Americans leave everything to share the gospel somewhere else? How does sharing the gospel look different in a Hindu context? Is there a difference between the way the East and the West thinks about faith? We'll talk about that and much more with two very special guests on today's Theology on Air. Well, we're joined today by A and J. Those are the names we're going to use for our guest today. They are missionaries in India. And so they're presenting Christianity, living alongside Hindu people. And they have a lot of stories to tell and a lot of insights to offer. And we wanted to have them on today, this episode of Theology on Air. Just a few quick notes of introduction. Theology on Air is a ministry of Theology on Tap, a ministry that meets now virtually monthly, hopefully in the future, every other month in person, around craft beer and theological conversation. And this is our podcast weekly portion of that. And we're also broadcasting on the HD2 channel of KPFT, which needs your funds, to be honest. To stay on the air, we need your funds. And so go to kpft.org and learn how to donate. If you want good radio content that is an hour long without any commercial interruptions or special pleading or anything like that, other than this plea right now, go to kpft.org and donate. And if you did so in the name of Theology on Air, we'd sure appreciate it. So kpft.org, where to go, is where you can go to learn more. But A and J, we're glad you're with us. And Sarah knows you, so Sarah, take it away.
Yeah, I love hearing their stories. I would love to just have you guys start us off maybe by telling us, you each have a different story of how you landed in India. And of course, then love blossomed and now you're a couple. But maybe A, you can go first and tell us what it was that made you even want to, I mean, you're so young to think about going around the world. And I know your family was like, okay, goodbye. You know, what made you want to do that? What makes you passionate about it? What's that been like? And then we'll switch over to Jay.
Yeah. Thanks for having us. I actually grew up in Houston and grew up going to church. I knew a lot about God. I could tell you all the stories. I could recite the verses. I was the star student in the youth group, if you want to call it that. But I really didn't understand what it meant to have a personal relationship with Jesus. And I didn't understand that so many people didn't know about Jesus. I just took it for granted, I think. So that kind of hit me in the face when I went to college, and someone from the organization that we work for now shared the gospel with me and asked me if I wanted to make a decision to follow Christ. And I was like, well, I thought that I had, but no one had ever asked me that before. And so that's kind of where my faith journey started. And that kind of led me on a passionate journey to know more about the Bible, to follow Jesus in a real life-transforming way. And so our organization at that time was like really focused in India. And so that was kind of what I started hearing about, learning about, was India. And of course, I mean, this is sad, but I was like, where even is India on a map? Like, how do I even find this place? And who are these people? And so I think my passion for the gospel going to all nations started later on in college. I wouldn't say India was like, I have to go there. There's like this calling of God to like go to India. I think Jay and I talk about it as like a common sense calling. And so it's like the most of the unreached population of the world is in India. And so that's just where the needs are. So we like need to go there. And so I think my senior year, I got an opportunity just for a 3-year commitment to go to India. And honestly, it was not like a glamorous process. I wasn't like, this is what I'm meant to do for my whole life or anything. I don't think I even loved India. I wasn't really passionate about the people there because I just didn't know them. I'd never been there. And so I was just kind of like, I have nothing to lose. I feel like this is what God wants me to do. I'm young. I'm not tied down. My parents, were sad, but they weren't throwing a fit about it. So I was just like, well, I think this is my chance to kind of experience a new culture. And so I think it was kind of after living there, now my passion is strong and now I love the people and the place. So that's a little bit about kind of how it all started.
And you're purposely not using your full names and you're not saying the name of the organization that sent you. I think most people think of, you know, different countries like China maybe being like, oh, we have to keep everything super secret, super safe. But I don't think people think that about India. Maybe explain why we're doing that.
Yeah. So in India, being a Christian isn't illegal, but, or even being a missionary is not illegal, but it's poorly looked upon. So if you tried to apply for a missionary visa or go there as a missionary, you wouldn't be let in. And so a lot of the staff and a lot of other organizations have been blacklisted, kicked out of India, because the government wants the Hindu religion and the Hindu culture to remain pure. And they think that it's kind of an infiltration to that.
Gotcha.
So we work on a business platform to allow us to be there. And so we just try to keep security really tight.
Okay. And Jay, tell us a little bit about your story, because you didn't end up there quite the same way.
Yeah. It was a little different. Some similarities, but I, you know, also grew up going to church and kind of in a similar way, you know, knew about God, did a lot of the church things. And then when I went to college, also with the same organization we're with now, was when I also started hearing the gospel for, you know, the first time of that. And I think the piece for me was more so like the lordship decision, and that when you're actually following Christ, that he has control and authority of all your decisions, how you live your life. And your life will be new and different if you start following Christ. And I had never heard that before. Yeah, started learning to share the gospel for the first time, read my Bible, pray, that I had an intimate relationship with God. And that was incredible. And then in college, towards the end, I started kind of hearing about this place in the world called the 1040 window. And okay, you know, interesting. And what it is, 10 degrees latitude and longitude and 40 degrees longitude in the, you know, other side of the world where the most unreached people live. And I didn't even know what the term unreached meant. But as I came to know, it means that less than 2% of the population knows about Christ.
Wow.
And unreached means that there's no one there to tell them about Jesus, even if they wanted to know. You know, so the world's becoming more, you know, connected to internet and stuff, and you can find, you know, anything you want. But if, you know, somebody wanted to know about Jesus, there's no one there to tell them. And so that was really, a catalyst for me at the common sense calling. And, you know, there wasn't like a burning bush or, you know, God didn't come to me in the dream or whatever, but it just made sense that, you know, I think that there was one missionary for every million people or something like that. Just some like, you know, ridiculous thing. And I'm like, man, if I want to be giving my life to something that no one else can do or will do. And that really drove me to want to go to India. And God actually grew my heart for India. I had a heart for India before I went. But I ultimately just saw that was a great, you know, opportunity. And I love it now and enjoy being there. So,
and a note is that these two things happened almost like 6 years apart. So we're like 6 years in age. And so he was there for a long time before I came to India.
So yeah, even kind of, you know, part of our story, I guess, is I ended up leading our team there. And then I was hiring, you know, new people to come join our team. I did an interview with her. I really enjoyed the interview. I had to go longer than other interviews. But I wouldn't say I liked her at that point. But, you know, over some time, seeing her in India, seeing her love for God, and just I knew I wanted to get to know her better. And, yeah.
And now you know her very, very well.
I know her very well. We've been married for over 2 years, and it's awesome. So yeah, I love getting to labor for the Lord alongside her, and definitely, I think just she makes our ministry more impactful. So, so it's awesome.
So sweet. You guys are inspiring and adorable. Okay, so tell us what exactly it is you're doing. Like you said, you're doing business something or other. What's the sort of auspices of what you're doing? What are you really doing? All the things.
Yeah. So we actually are. You know, we have a business platform to. You can't really go over and, you know, be accepted as a missionary. And so we do business, and what we do for our business front is we export products from India to the US. And so we're kind of the middleman in between American companies who are buyers and Indian companies who are sellers. And we do quality control for the American company and a lot of things of that sort to pretty much help that transaction go on. So that's kind of what we do on the business front. And then on the ministry front, we're hoping to see churches planted through high caste Hindus. And so that's kind of specifically who we're working with. And, you know, these people who have never heard Christ before, sharing the gospel with them, teaching them how to follow Jesus, teaching them as disciples how to make disciples, and kind of from then organically growing into like a house church and then multiplying house churches.
Okay, let me pause you there for a second because I want to ask more about how you're doing that. But you said something that I think is going to trigger the ears of our listeners. You said you're appealing to, and I know this already, you're reaching out to high caste Hindus. Talk a little bit about the caste system. A lot of people think the caste system is not alive and well. And then why it is that you're going after the creme de la creme, as it were. Why?
Yeah, great question. So the caste system definitely over time has, I think, I want to say diminished, but it's not as like, I don't know, how do you say
it? Was technically abolished by law.
Yeah, technically abolished by law, but people still in everyday life, you definitely can tell who's...
It is ingrained in society.
Who has what jobs, like the lower castes have like your street sweepers or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it might be. And higher caste people, you know, might have be like upper like businessmen or something like that. So it's not necessarily economic because there have been some castes who have like moved, like lower castes have kind of moved up the economic mm-hmm. and influential rungs, if you will. But for the most part, it kind of does work out economically as well.
And to clarify, you can't change castes. Like once you're born into a certain caste, like you can't become from low caste to high caste. It's not like climb that kind of ladder, but they've made a lot of provisions for low caste people to have like spots in colleges and to be educated and to have jobs. And so, yeah, you can't say all low caste are poor, all high caste are rich. But I think the main ways it plays out is in marriage and family community dynamics. We work with high caste. All of our friends are high caste, and the thought of their child marrying someone in like a lower caste is still very like
taboo.
Yeah, taboo.
Yeah. And yeah, so, I mean, even over here in America, I've got a friend who's had two breakups because she wasn't a high enough caste. Mm-hmm. And if everybody's watching Indian Matchmaker on Netflix, no. Same thing.
I was going to say, do y'all know about that show?
Yeah. Pretty accurate. Yeah.
But A, continue and tell us why it is you're reaching out then to the high caste folks.
Yeah. So over the course of like Indian history, most missionaries and people, NGOs, are serving the low caste. And so like Mother Teresa, a lot of NGOs are working towards like those people because, you know, they're the most like physically needy. And a lot of people have said like reaching high caste Hindus for Christ is impossible. It can't be done. And because, you know, they have it all, you know, they're living the high life in India and they just don't have a lot of needs, but they're also a lot of times the most affluent. And so I think we want to reach them because they're the unreached castes of India. So if you look in like Operation World or any of those books, like the unreached people of India, all those castes, a lot of them are high caste. And so, I mean, we're trying to fulfill, like do our part to fulfill the Great Commission, and that's a huge part of it. And so our organization has committed itself to learning the best ways to reach high caste Hindus. And
so would it be easier in a way to reach low caste Hindus because they have such obvious needs, like, you know, ministry needs, like health, you know, impoverished needs, right? So like the contact is easier to be there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's why I think 70% of missions to India do go to low caste.
Okay.
And so like, because like it would be easier to do that, but so that's why a lot of people are probably doing it. And so this is such a,
like, you can take food and go to orphanages, but to reach high caste Hindus, you have to live in sustainable, authentic relationships with them and like become like them over the long haul to like see fruit. And it's just hard.
If you're able to reach a high caste Hindu, does that sort of filter down? Like, does their influence kind of rain down? Obviously, I'm going to assume it's not going to rain up, right? If you reach low caste Hindus.
Yeah. So that's kind of our vision statement, is seeing India reached with the gospel from the highest Brahmin to the most forgotten street child. And mostly that, like, even with the lower caste, like, there's definitely like a language barrier there too. And so upper caste people, they speak English, so we can relate really well to them easier. They're more westernized, I think, in some ways, because they, you know, they watch all the American TV shows. Mm-hmm. And so we just have a lot of relatability on those levels, but that they also have the influence as, you know, government leaders, teachers, businessmen, they have the influence to then influence the lower caste. And so, yeah, it's not that we're like, hey, we're never, you know, want to impact lower caste, but because we want to impact lower caste, we need to go to people who can reach them first.
Trickle down theology.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also, like, we someday, like, we would love to not be there, and that the upper caste people, and like, they have, you know, reached their own people. But if, like, we're the ones bringing, you know, the resources and things like that, then they're reliable on us as Westerners. Mm-hmm. And so we, you know, would love for them to be, as Indians, providing for the lower caste people themselves, so they become believers and grow a heart for the poor and the orphans and the widows.
So that's a major part of your discipleship too, is with our friends, is like trying to grow their paradigm for reaching low caste, or to, you know, having a heart for those people.
So give us like a typical, what kinds of things are you actually doing other than the business side of things? You talked about authentic relationships. Mm-hmm. Tell us what like kind of your days look like, what you're doing.
So we live in a huge apartment complex, and it has at full capacity about 8,000 people in it. And so we just spend days like meeting neighbors. We go out to malls and meet people. We go to busy streets and engage people there. We used to go to a lot of like colleges and universities also to meet students, but we've kind of shifted more towards like focusing on families and communities in that way. So we just like build relationships, and a lot of days is spent like going out, meeting people, or then hanging out with like already built friendships. And so it's amazing like how receptive Indians are. It's not like in America where people are like, why is this weird person talking to me? Like they are just, they love having new friends. They love doing that kind of stuff. So maybe in a day we would have like a meeting with our team in the morning, and we'd have like a lunch appointment with a friend. And then we'd have like maybe a few other like appointments with friends throughout the day, chai, tea, and then maybe like a dinner appointment. And so Jay and I do a lot of ministry together with couples. And so spending time at their houses with them, that's a simplified version of what we are doing.
I think Evan is writing down all the times that we slip. So I don't know what he's going to do, put like a boing sound or something there, but for those of our listeners, if you've heard some beeps, it's because we've accidentally used names.
Or if it was just the sentence just seemed to jump quickly past a proper name that was there.
I think we should pick a ridiculous noise. We'll discuss that later. Yeah. But what I would love to hear you guys talk about some is this idea of contextualization. You are doing evangelism very differently than we would do it here in America because of the ways that people believe, because of Hinduism, because of Eastern thinking. I remember having a conversation with you where I told you that I went to an interfaith ministry's like lunch and learn, and they talked about a big difference between Eastern and Western thought when it comes to faith is Westerners care a lot more about orthodoxy, what is right, what is true, and an Eastern mindset cares a lot more about orthopraxy. What do you do? What duties are you fulfilling? What are you obligated to do? And that kind of thing. So maybe talk a little bit about how a Hindu mindset or even just a more Eastern mindset demands different kinds of conversation and lead-ins and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. I love talking about this. I think one big reason for why we do contextualization is because of the baggage that comes along with being a Christian. And that baggage even starts with when the British came to India. They brought Christianity with them, kind of like a colonialism way, mm-hmm. and we're pretty much like, hey, this is this pagan land, this pagan country, and all you people, you need to convert to the one true God, but in order to do that, you have your names after your gods. You don't eat, you know, you only eat vegetables, like, you know, you don't eat beef or anything like that, and like all this stuff is kind of attached to this pagan life. And so to prove that you're not a Hindu, you need to change your name from, you know, Ravi or Akash or whatever, to Peter or John or Jesus. Like I think I met a guy named Abraham Ebenezer.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. And so like this idea, hey, it's, you know, Jesus plus all these things. And actually we're going to make you eat beef to prove that you are no longer Hindu and that you're a Christian, to really show like your conversion, to make sure.
Doesn't this ring familiar with like circumcision?
Absolutely.
In the Testament, and then, yeah, okay.
Yeah, so it's just crazy how similar that is. So long story short, there's a lot more there, but the British put these Jesus plus, you know, restrictions on, you know, Hindus coming in. So Hindus were very turned off to the gospel at that point in time.
Sure.
And so what they think now is, even with like some churches in India, I can't say that's all of them, but some of them are still saying you need to completely renounce your family, leave your pagan family and come join, you know, the church with us. And so that's one of the large reasons that we do contextualization is that, you know, we see in scriptures of even in like 1 Corinthians of becoming all things to all people. And, you know, Jesus was even incarnate in himself becoming like us, you know, to reach us. And so we just do everything we can to remove every barrier possible. And so that's like even different names, like instead of Jesus, we say Yeshu, which actually Jesus' name, Yeshua, was, you know, a lot, you know, similar, or, you know, we use their own language to communicate some spiritual truths and things like that. So that's one of the main reasons why we do contextualization. Mm-hmm. Would you add anything? What do you think?
No, that's a great reason why we do contextualization. Yeah. There's a lot more there with like Eastern thinking and kind of how we change our approach if we're ready to get into that.
Yeah, go. Just go. Sounds good.
So I think one of the main differences that we've noticed is just that like in America or Western, you would sit across the table from someone and you'd explain to them like, here's the gospel. Like, you know, kind of, yeah, what you said, fact-based, like, here it is, like, this is why you need Christ, you have sin, and that separates you from God, and here you go, here's your decision, you know, the same way that we both, like, chose to follow Christ, and probably a lot of other people, but in India, that just doesn't, like, compute. They are much more experiential, and so we share the gospel, for sure, like, in word, and explanation, but so much more than that too is in those sustainable relationships, we are guiding them to encounter Jesus and to have experiences with him. And so it's rocked my paradigm of thinking for sure. It's just like, how do you really not just tell someone, but you are walking alongside them to introduce them to the person of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so that's so much more of our thinking when it comes to sharing the gospel and helping them to understand, because they need those, what we call, or in India called like anubhav, which means like a spiritual experience basically. And so we're trying to create like times of prayer or times of meditation or times of worship that really helps them to have those anubhav or experiences with God. And so I think that's a major difference, for sure, with Eastern thinking. And it honestly is hard for the Western mind because fruit comes slower. You know, my friend recently started following Jesus as her only God, which we can get to exclusivity also. But I was in close relationship with her and her family for 3 years before that happened. And so it's just a long process, but it's just not as black and white as here's the gospel. Yes,
yeah.
No.
I think at one point you told me, and I am going to let Evan ask a question after this. Okay. I'm hogging the show. You said something about some kind of a challenge where you ask people to pray to Jesus only for like a week or something. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I think prayer is a big part of Hindu religion. And so if they needed something, they would go to a temple and pray. And I think, you know, they pray to these different gods for different things. And so asking them to pray to Jesus, like, isn't totally crazy. Sure. And so but the thing is, like, I would want them to pray to him only so that they know that the answered prayer is from him. And so that's been something that I've challenged my friends, and we've, like, a lot has happened through prayer with them. I think that's some of the biggest fruitful experiences we've seen. And so then they come back and that's like an anubhav experience. Like what I was saying is, you know, oh, like I prayed to Yeshu and for a week and my mom is better. She was healed. Or I had so much peace going into my exam.
So
that's just like a way for us to like help them to experience Jesus through prayer.
And I think one other thing I just wanted to add to that is that kind of our you know, way that we worship with them is that Indians, they sit on the floor when they worship, and they'll use like kind of like little hand drums or like hand cymbals, and they like love singing like worship songs like in their language and things like that. And so, or they'll wear like certain clothes. And so we do all of those things. We sit on the floor, and they're very like an oral culture. And so telling stories is a way to like connect with them. Mm-hmm. And we even, you know, use things from their culture to like, I guess, kind of point to Jesus in some ways with contextualization. And so one of the biggest, like, I don't know, you probably mantra, like their biggest mantra says, lead me from falsehood to truth. Lead me from death to immortality. Lead me from darkness to light.
Wow.
And you're like, huh, interesting. Yeah. And so, you know, we'll, you know, chant that with our friends. And like, actually, you know, India has been chanting this for thousands of years, asking for God to give them this. Ooh. And Jesus saying, hey, Jesus is this. Mm-hmm. And so we, contextualization, we look, you know, we learn a lot about their cultures and their scriptures and things like that. And like, Jesus is the true fulfillment of what you're, you know, you're searching for.
Hadley, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Love it.
So I'm interested in, because my very limited understanding of the East or Hinduism is that really its foundations are so very different. For example, in the West, we're linear, right? Like our time is, you know, there's a beginning and there's an end, which is why if you sit down with a Westerner and talk about, like, there are some things that even a Westerner would just intuitively understands. Like, they probably intuitively understand that they're a sinner in a certain way, even, that it offends God. And they probably assume that, I mean, it's fashionable to believe in reincarnation now. You know, Julia Roberts is a Hindu. I don't know if y'all know that.
Eat, pray, love, baby.
Yeah. But you know, I mean, so it's fashionable for people to talk about reincarnation and karma and things like that, which I do want to ask about. But I'm curious as to, because my understanding of the Hindus would understand that time is cyclical and life, like lives is just kind of repeating over and over, and but you are reincarnated. So maybe there's not as much urgency. Hmm. Whereas for us, like, there's urgency because when you die, that's it. So I'm curious, do you need to have those kinds of conversations first, or do you just really try to get them to have a relationship with Yeshu? I want to say that correctly, but you know, what do you kind of try to do first? Do you try to say, actually, well, you know, time is linear and it began at a certain point and it's all going to end at a certain point. You know what I'm saying? Like, where do you kind of start? Cause that would seem pretty important. It's all important.
Yeah. I think we've kind of landed that there is so many hills to climb up, you know, there's so many like battles to fight when it comes to that, because I mean, even their idea of God isn't like our idea of like the creator. And so it's, you're just kind of like, where do I even begin? It's overwhelming. But we definitely don't really try to break down the things that are wrong about their thinking. We're not like, hey, reincarnation's not true or karma. We just think those things will come. And so as they start to learn and read the Bible, a lot of times our friends just kind of read the scriptures and start to realize that that's not the case. And so we are just kind of facilitating that, those realizations. We've just found it not to be super fruitful to be like, here's where you're wrong. Here's why this isn't right. But I also think they still feel urgency. I think there is an idea that I am where I am in this life because of my past life, and I want to do good in this life so that I have a good reincarnation. I don't necessarily think that the modern Hindu necessarily dwells on that, and like they don't just like saunter through life as a result of that. I think more is that there's like kind of this idea of life stages and like duty, which they call like dharma. And so that is more of, I think, why they lack urgency is because when you're young, your duty is to like be a child and to grow up and to learn. And then when you reach adolescence, your duty is to be a good son or a good daughter, to get educated, get a job and get married, and to do whatever your parents tell you. But then once you get older, that's when your spiritual time comes. That's when like you are entering into when the end of your life. And so that's when you need to get serious about spiritual things. And so a lot of times in Hindu families, you'll see the grandparents, well, they all live together, but the grandparents are the ones that are the most spiritual. They're leading the family spiritually, is because like that's their stage of life right now. And so a lot of times the urgency piece comes in with our friends who we normally reach out to people like 18 to 40, I'd say, just because we have the most connection with them. I'd say that they're not super like, I need to figure out this spiritual stuff and I'm seeking truth right now, because that's not really what is like their focus in life.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
They're making money. They have a job. I was just real fast before Sarah has an awesome question, I know. But I was curious if the secularism bug is hitting, say, India as hard as, say, America, right? I mean, where there's just so much non-religious, you know, going on. And maybe it's not just the stage of life, but, like, they're just like, I'm done, you know, there's other better things to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually, like, really kind of excited about that in some regards, because I think in this generation, you're seeing in India Hindus who are like, okay, I'll do all the rituals, I'll worship this god, this idol, I'll show up for all the festivals and things like that. But in my heart, like, I don't believe that, like, this, you know, idol I'm worshiping is actually God. And they're searching. And so I think in this generation, you're seeing them kind of become more detached, more secular, kind of like you said. And I think it's just more than ever, like, the harvest is plentiful and just ripe in India. And so, like, gets us more excited about being there. So I think they're definitely more secular than ever, and becoming more Western too.
For sure. I feel like the major difference is that they're secular, but they won't act on that as much as American young people. But young people in India, it's like tons more saying that they're atheists, a lot more saying, you know, they believe in the energy inside of them and agnostic and stuff like that.
Seems like there would be less deconstruction to have to do at that point, because you're like, okay, we're sort of working from a blank canvas instead of like wrong information that has to, yeah. So a quick question, do you guys speak the language? Is it Hindi where you are?
So the national language is Hindi, but almost each state has their own state language. So we've kind of started learning the state language, which is, if I told you that, you know.
Then you have to kill me. Right. I get it. Okay.
And then we have one in the state language a little bit. Yeah.
A little bit. And I know their prayers are often in Sanskrit. Is that right? So then you're having to learn, like, the mantra you referred to. Is that in a different language than the super secret one you can't tell me?
That's Sanskrit. Yeah. But, like, a lot of the languages derive from Sanskrit, so you'll see some of the similarities in there, yeah. So.
And I assume a lot of them speak English, because you guys don't have, you're not fluent in, again, the language that we shall not name. It's like Voldemort. Like,
right. Don't
not fluent.
So we do have some teams, so there's 8 teams across India in different cities, and they, like, might have to learn the language more because English might be, like, less prevalent. But in the city we're in, like, a lot more people speak English, so we're not, like, going as, like, all in. But some of our teams do become fluent in the language.
It gains us a lot of favor, for sure, with people to speak the language and to know some words. Like, even you throw out a few words, they're like, oh my gosh, like, she speaks the language. But we don't really have a huge need to be fluent, which kind of nice.
I would ask you to say something, but if someone were listening that spoke that very super secret language, then they would know. So, okay. But you mentioned something earlier I want to come back to. You said something about the exclusivity idea. Mm-hmm. And I've heard you say something about this before, that you will invite people to meet and follow Jesus on the path to following him alone, which, of course, the Orthodox Christians in America, like, makes them very nervous. So tell us a little bit about that, and maybe also weave in just a very quick lesson on, of course, it's not monotheistic, but there is some idea of, like, a creator, a destroyer, and like a sustainer. So where does Jesus fit into that kind of context?
So I'll talk about exclusivity.
Okay.
And talk about the rest. Exclusivity. I mean, we know you follow one God, and that is you're committed to God. And in Hindu religion, there's 330 million gods, and you can have whichever of them you want to follow. Most families have, I'd say, like, a handful that they are, like, most dedicated to. And so it's just, like, this idea that there doesn't need to be one god that you, like, choose only. And so a lot of our friends will say, yeah, like I would love to follow Jesus. But really what they're saying is, yeah, I'll pray to him sometimes when I need it, but I'm going to add him in with the rest of my gods. And so a lot of our conversations and a lot of our prayer goes towards that they would see that God, that Jesus is the one true God. And honestly, from our experience, the Spirit and Jesus' work in their life is the only way that they will see that he is the one true God. And all the believers that we know that we are like helping to grow, it was that same process. Like they met Jesus, then he elevated himself to the point that they did not want any of their other gods.
It's amazing to me. I mean, it's like gives me goosebumps. Anyway, continue. Yeah. Sorry.
We never like talk trash on their gods mm-hmm. or say they're not real or any of that. Like Jesus does it. We point them to the scripture and they like Jesus does it. And so it's
Jesus
so cool.
does his own trash talking. He doesn't need you to.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. So it is really cool to see God's, you know, word is living and active and that it does really go to work when you bring people to it. Mm-hmm. And so, sorry, I didn't want to.
Oh no, that's great. Yeah. I was going to have a quick book pub. If anyone's more interested in this, this idea comes from Disciple Making Among Hindus by Tim Schultz. He has a diagram that's basically like a stair step. And so it's like the four stages, which it's just hard to put any like Hindus in a box. Like they will climb perfectly up these stairs. It's a whole lot more clear than that. But basically the idea is like, they start as like, what's the first one? Jesus is
one of many.
Jesus is one of many gods. And then Jesus is their favorite God. Jesus is the only God for them. And then Jesus is the only God for everybody.
Ooh, I love that.
It's just, it's so true how like you kind of see your friends like progress through that. Like he's okay. He's one God. Like he's one of the gods. And then you see Jesus like elevate himself. Like, okay, he's definitely my favorite. I pray to him the most. I want to read the Bible the most. Mm-hmm. Then yes, he is the only God that I follow. And I'm committed to like not worshiping idols. And then, oh, I see the need. Everyone needs to follow only Jesus because he is the only way to eternal life. So I think that's like a good way to kind of think about it. Like the exclusivity piece, but we also have to come back to that a lot with our friends. I feel like that's a conversation that they're constantly asking us about.
Like why does Jesus need to be exclusive kind of thing? Like why can't I, yeah.
Like, why can't I just follow him and all my other gods? Like, why do I have to choose? Why do I have to pick him? And
which I was going to share about our engagement thing.
Oh, yeah.
So in the like Hindu culture, it's like pretty common to have like a huge like engagement party and things mm-hmm. like that. You do like a time of worship and like all the, you know, kirtas and all that stuff. And we sat on the floor and we kind of got to share our love story, but also we got to share God's love story for the people and for everyone. And, you know, even talked about just relationship in general and say, man, A, she would be, if we were going to get married and I asked her, hey, can I add another wife
in
a relationship? Can I have another one? Or, you know, maybe
or
five more, you know, why not? Like, and, but then that would make, and I'd ask, you know, how would that make A feel? And like, you know, jealous, like that's wrong. Like, Jay, you would be messed up to do that. And so like kind of turn it the same way, like, man, God, he wants our full attention. He's a jealous God. He, and this is how he showed his love for us. And so using kind of things similar to that, we use that life stage event of being engaged to be able to like kind of point to the gospel and share through that way. Mm-hmm. So,
and I still use that illustration all the time, like with my friends, if I'm ever trying to like explain that.
Yeah,
I love that. And then Jay, were you going to kind of walk through the sort of basic theology of the how they think of creator, sustainer, and where Jesus fits into that? Or maybe that's not.
I don't know. It is I think a pretty complex idea. But yeah, they would have, you know, different gods who, you know, is the creator, one's the sustainer, and one's the destroyer. And I, you know, as time goes on, I think people are less, you know, kind of bought into that idea. So I don't know.
And I think all the other gods are supposed to be like avatars of those three.
Yeah.
And so like they kind of view them as like the main biggest ones. I kind of, in my mind, I view them like Jesus doesn't fit in with them. He's just kind of like, it's separate.
Yeah.
I don't think
so. You're not trying to set him up as sort of the creator. You're just saying, like, throw him in the pantheon, see how it works. We know that it's going to work because we know he's the one true God.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even, like, if we're telling a story, like, one of the stories that we tell is creation to, like, church, and just, like, through the large, you know, story of the Bible, we'll talk about God as the creator, and we'll talk about Yeshua as, you know, being God also. And so we're not, like, directly saying, like, okay, your creator is wrong, you know, our creator is right, but just, like, tell the story, and they're like, oh, yeah, cool, that makes sense. They're like, that's great. So they don't, like, you know, debate back and be like, actually, the real creator
is Brahma
and all that stuff. So they're very, like, just open-minded, I think, when talking about
it. And it's amazing, like, our friends who are believers, like, the understanding that they come to, like, through conversation through the scriptures. Like, they would all say, like, we didn't sit down and be like, okay, now God is the creator. We didn't, like, tell them, walk through that specifically. But they all know, like, God and Jesus are, and the Spirit are one, and he is the creator. And so it's kind of like when they follow Jesus, like, there's no longer a need to, like, figure out how Jesus works with all the other ones.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So could your friends or the people you minister to, could they, like, turn you in? I mean, you have the business there. It's a legitimate business. Could you still get in trouble because you had, what's the threshold of, or at that point, can you just say, hey, look, we're having a friendly conversation. I can't be held. I'm just.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess they could.
They definitely could. I think we just really tried to, like, that relationship is just, you know, so.
But they wouldn't do that because.
They would never do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And explain it to them, like, hey, you know, we took this job because not a lot of people in India know about Jesus, and no matter where we live, we're going to tell people about Jesus. And so we just chose to take this job specifically because we know people in India, like, need to know about Jesus.
And it's a real job, right? Like, you're not just there, like, doing, like, phony paperwork or something. Like,
not in the CIA.
Yeah.
They see our business, and, you know, we've worked to get, like, internship programs and stuff so they can, like, kind of be a part of that. And so it's totally legit. And it's just funny, like, Jay and I had an incident getting through immigration one time a few years ago. And, like, our friends were outraged.
Okay, so do you have any stories of, like, I don't know, just moments that you've had? I think, I've heard you at least say one or two of these, like, women that you have been friends with, and then there was a moment where it was either a conversation or something that they experienced that you could see there's real fruit of what you guys are doing there. Mm-hmm. Any of those you might want to share? I just want to make sure we get that in before we lose our time.
Yeah. So one of the friend that I mentioned earlier, we had been processing about Jesus and talking about him for about a year probably. And she was asking a lot of those questions. Like, why do I have to, like not follow my other gods? Like, why does Jesus want me to follow him only? And so I think it was probably about 5 instances where Jesus really, like, revealed himself to her. One of them was probably the coolest one, was that she was in, like, a group interview setting, and they're all sitting around in a circle, and the question that the guy had asked, she didn't know the answer to, and she looked up and she saw, like, a picture of Jesus, or what she, like, thought, and, like, he was, like, kind of a reminder to her. And so she, like, started praying to Jesus, like, please, like, it's like a small prayer, but like I pray that, like, you'd give me the answer or something. But the moderator guy skipped over her. Like, he asked everyone else the question, but not her.
Huh.
So she saw that as, like, a sign that Jesus, like, had her best and was, like, there for her. And so I'd say probably about 4 or 5 other instances of answered prayer. Her mom was really sick and, like, was healed. And a few other times of us praying together, sometimes over exams or boys and things like that. But those things added up. And I think those were huge instances.
I think one story that comes to mind is one of my friends I have known for a long time, probably about 5 or 6 years. And he became a believer pretty early on, but his dad was friends with some of the, like, conservative Hindu people who, like, persecute Christians pretty much in India. And his dad still went to them. Like his dad, or like our friend, started leading times of worship. His dad was so proud of him. He started telling them, and he's like, "Hey, my son is now leading these worship times in our home." And he's like, they were so proud of him. And so his like already like it impacted his family, but then it started impacting like, you know, other circles of like these government officials. But, you know, kind of going back to contextualization, they're like, oh, wow. They're like not bringing him like to go to church or something like that, but they're doing this worship in our home. And so his dad was like proud enough to tell these government people who like hate Christians that like, hey, my son is leading these worship times to Jesus, but still in our culture. And so I think that was a big, like, kind of cool story that just like that influence of that family influenced so many more people. Mm-hmm. But then later on, his dad actually passed away. He had a heart attack. And in a Hindu tradition, they have 12 days of ceremonies afterwards. And pretty much each day you're doing these rituals to get the spirit of the soul to heaven, what their idea of what heaven is, or like on to the next life. And our friend, he had the opportunity to like lead a time of worship, and I got to lead it with him, where we got to share the gospel. Like a lot, like there's like 30 or 40 people in their house all crammed in, and like they had to hear the gospel and things like that. And so it was just really cool to see our friend being bold with his faith and wanting his family members and community to like know about Jesus. So I don't know, that's one of many, like we could go on with stories, but.
There's one other one that came to mind, which is actually not about our friend. It's a girl on our team. She had come to a family's house and had like prepared like a story to like share with them like during the worship time. And it was a story about, I don't remember which one exactly, but about buying land, something about land and property. And the family, the grandma was like, this is like from God, because they were like trying to figure out a land dispute in their family and something. And so they're very much like impacted by those kinds of things. Like, wow, like you, the story that God told you to say, share from the Bible, like exactly matched up with a situation in our lives that you had no idea was like going on. And so the grandma then after that, she used to make them worship Jesus in front of the idol closet. And then she like wouldn't sing, she would just stare at the idols like during the worship time. And then after that, she was like, no, next time we'll do the worship like outside. And she like closed the doors to their like idol closet and like sang along. And so it was just like a really cool like turning point for that family.
I would imagine that as so much of this is experiential and sort of these like God moments, where when I hear that kind of stuff here in America, I'm so cynical. I'm like, but was it God? And, right. But you guys are almost going to have to always say it very well could have been, right. That might be, I don't know. I would think that would have to be like a shift for you as well, to just be open to God is going to do what he's going to do in his way. And we're just going to have to say yes to it all because he's doing his own thing and just be along for the ride.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's pretty wild.
So yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I was just along that same line. I was thinking about how kind of different your approach is from ours, but like maybe ours should be more like yours in the sense that we have, for example, I mean, our ministry is to a degree an apologetics ministry. Which in many ways is about, you know, kind of building rational arguments, you know, for the existence of God and the resurrection of Jesus and da-da-da-da, which I do take some issue with because I think it assumes certain things. And ultimately, conversion is a spiritual matter, whether you're in the East or the West. And it's kind of like y'all are basically inviting people to a relationship first and letting the Holy Spirit work in the lives of people. And we're like begging and pleading for them to like think that we're rational. Believing in God and believing right. that he was his son. So it's like a sequential, everything we do in the West, I guess, is sequential, right? You know, and it seems like we could learn a lot from your approach. It would seem strange maybe in this context, but maybe not anymore since many Westerners are fundamentally pagan. But maybe we need to start basically saying, you know, why don't you pray to Jesus, you know?
Try it out. Yeah. Well, that's actually a great segue I wanted to ask you this. For those of us that are Christians here in America, and we have friends who are Hindu, give us some ideas, tips, tricks, strategies to use to engage in those. I mean, I have some friends that are Hindu that I've engaged in so many conversations, and it's pleasant. It's always pleasant. But there's never any sort of movement of thought, it doesn't feel like. And I know I'm probably doing it wrong because I'm thinking all linear and proof based. And right. Do you have any suggestions for me or for others like me?
Yeah, man. Isn't it awesome how just cordial Indians are?
Like, yes.
For
instance, I have, and she may listen to this, I have a friend who comes sometimes to my Bible study, and she enjoys it. And she'll say things, God this, God that. And but once in a while, I'll say something about, God, Jesus being the only way and us having sin. And she'll say, well, that bothered me that you said that, you know. Mm-hmm. But she keeps coming back. So, yeah, it's a little puzzling about where to go next, as it were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think one thing to like think about is like even the paradigm of thinking is, A, mentioned this earlier, but the mindset, you know, as Americans, we're very individual mindset, and Indians are very community, you know, mindset. And so when you're asking an Indian or a Hindu, hey, would you want to follow Jesus? What they're thinking about is, how is this going to impact my family? And it's mm-hmm. a big honor shame culture. And so if they were to make that decision to follow Jesus, that could bring shame on them, but also shame on their family and their community and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the paradigm like you have to work with. It's like, if it's not an individual, it's as if you're asking the question to them and their parents are sitting right next to them. And so it's not an individual decision for them. But I think just inviting them to like read with you has been like really successful for us, or just asking, hey, what can I pray for, mm-hmm. you know, in your life? And just kind of keep, you know, following up and checking in on those things, but just kind of like coming alongside their lives, and getting invested and, you know, caring for them. And, I think, yeah, just how you love them will really stand out for mm-hmm. sure.
And I think you just have to go against everything in you to like tell them like what's right and what's wrong, and here's the scriptures, and here's why, like the apologetics and all this stuff, because to them, I mean, you know, if she keeps showing up, like that's great. But I don't think that for most Hindus, like those kinds of things are not going to be what is going to lead them to Jesus. And so if I had Hindu friends living here, I probably wouldn't necessarily be like, hey, come to church with me. I would try to like, hey, how do you feel comfortable? Like, you know, worshiping, do you want to meditate together? Yeah, do you want to think about this one psalm that like makes you feel peaceful? Or do you want to pray together? I guess I don't have a ton of experience with Indians in America, but you know, a lot of times it's even the atmosphere, like we light like a lamp in India, and that just like sitting together like with the lamp and like praying is just so much more fruitful than like, hey, let's study this passage. Like, what's your main takeaway? What's your application? Why do you think that Jesus is real? And things like that and it just goes against everything in me. Because, you know, we are still Westerners, even though we sometimes seem like we're completely turned Eastern. But so I think I would, you know, start with facilitating ways that they can experience God in one-on-one, not in groups. And another thing I would say is there's this kind of idea of like covenant relationships in India, where like being there for their big life events and celebrating them on their birthdays and things like that are just so important. And like, once you get into a covenant relationship, it's basically like, there's no getting out of it. Like, you are the one, you have to be there for the aunt's step, blah, blah, blah's birthday.
Yeah.
Like, you have to be there for that. And I think that's still true. Like, that's still ingrained in your friend's mind probably, and in all other Indians. And so maybe like finding ways that you can show love to them, not through like theological or spiritual like conversations, and like attribute that. Even a lot of times I'm like, hey, you know, I do this because like Yeshu is like working in me and like enabling me to love or to be patient. Like those small teaching moments, if you're doing life on life with them. Mm-hmm.
That's good.
So we only have like 3 minutes or so, because I'm going to edit a little bit. Can I, and we might go a little bit long. Can we put this on YouTube?
Yeah.
We can put this on
YouTube. Oh, can we put this on YouTube after we blank out your mistakes?
Sure. I mean, would you see us?
Oh yeah, we can't do that.
You can put a voice out or something like that.
Okay, no, it'll just be a podcast then. So,
okay.
But let me try to ask some like kind of pithy questions and like give super short answers because it might be stuff that people think about, right? You said 330 million gods. Okay, are cows gods? Is that part of the 330 million? Cows, it's a dumb question, I know.
Gods are in cows.
Okay. Ah. Okay.
Cows are holy.
Every time I eat a steak, I agree with that statement. Go ahead.
Cows are holy because they give you milk. It's like they provide for you, so therefore you should respect them and honor them.
Is karma good or bad?
Neither.
Okay.
She looks like she's on a quiz show. She's like, and the answer
is neutral.
Do a lot of people in India follow gurus? Is that really a thing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Okay. Like casually, or I mean, what percentage of people would you say have a guru?
Oh, I would say a large percent.
Over 50?
Yeah, a large percent.
Oh, wow. I thought you might say 10 or something at most. So, and then finally, the Apostle Thomas was said to go to India. What do you think? What have you heard? And I mean, I know there's a church named after Thomas there, but do you think that that's possible?
I do think that it's possible. And also kind of in the locations where they would say that he was at, there are like a lot of kind of churches there.
Mm-hmm. Churched.
Yeah. And so that's kind of like, it's crazy that the gospel's been there for thousands of years, you know, at least 2000 plus years, but India is still incredibly underreached.
I think he was there.
Yeah.
So if people want to partner with you in prayer and those kinds of things, can they reach out to me and I can connect them? Or do you want to just kind of keep this, you know, do you want to friend zone the listeners is what I'm saying?
No, they could reach out to you and on a personal email, we could talk to whoever wants to.
And like we send out updates and things like that too. So if they get, you know, in touch with you, we can get their emails.
Add them, to the
list. We love having more people and letting just more people be a part of what God's doing in India.
And you wouldn't refuse people giving you money either, right?
No.
Yeah.
Okay. You guys fund your whole salaries, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. We do raise. Okay.
Raise funds, I should say. You don't fund them. You raise your own funds. Well, we've got to say goodbye for today, but man, I love that you guys came out. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for just sharing all of these stories with us. It's so fascinating. We might have to have you on again. But to our listeners who will hopefully join us again next week, as always, until we hear from you again, we encourage you to question freely, think deeply, and disagree as needed.